You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Caroline Hyde in New York, in for Emily Chang, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, the New York City subway shooting. The suspect has been arrested and faces terrorism charges. We'll bring you the details this hour. Meanwhile, the shares of Lithium Corporation sold 280% after a completely fake press release claimed EV giant Tesla had bought the Nevada miner. Bloomberg got to the bottom of it. And crypto startup Circle, it lands $400 million in funding from investors like BlackRock and Fidelity. What that means for broader institutional adoption of crypto, later this hour. First and foremost, we bring you a story close to home for us right now, biggest story of the day. We got him. Those were the words from the New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Law enforcement officials say they have arrested Frank James in Manhattan in connection with Tuesday's shooting at a Brooklyn subway station. New York City Police Commissioner Keyshawn Sewell says the 62-year-old was apprehended with the help of the public.
Officers, in response to a Crime Stoppers tip, stopped Mr. James at 1:42 p.m. at the corner of St. Mark's Place and First Avenue in Manhattan. He was taken into custody without incident and has been transported to an NYPD facility.
Now, police say James has 9 prior arrests in New York, dating back between 1992 to 1998. At least 23 people, of course, were hurt in yesterday's attack when he let off 33 shots, we understand, from his firearm. Joining now is Fola Akinibi. And Fola, you've been reporting on the ground about this and understanding really the ramifications this has for the city's leadership. But first and foremost, 30 hours this man was on the streets of New York, on the subway of New York, on other perhaps forms of public transit. Is this being deemed a success or not, do you think?
I was at NYPD headquarters when officials made the announcement, and officials seemed to be deeming this a success. But in the aftermath of the attack, it was reported that cameras in the subway station were out. James, the suspected shooter, was said to have left the station and entered another station at 9:15 a.m. And then officials said those were his last known whereabouts, and that was more than 24 hours ago. And so then he was eventually apprehended at 1 p.m. So there are at least 24 hours that officials have not explained or have not been able to explain where this person was.
An extraordinary use of technology and failing of technology with the cameras, which the NYPD, it felt, was very quick to make out was the responsibility of MTA, the, of course, public transit, to be looking after and ensuring. However, technology has been used, whether it be from, just the social media clips that we see of the man that actually helped apprehend him from the streets, but also the way in which we, as the members of the public, were sent messages through our phones, ways that we gave tips and the like. Do you think that this is also a test in a way of crime prevention with a relatively new administration here in New York?
Yeah, and Mayor Eric Adams has suggested that he would like to use even more technology to help prevent crime. It's not clear what exactly he plans to do. There has been a lot of talk about, again, the cameras at the subway station and whether there needs to be a review of what happened there and of the cameras in the entire system and whether there needs to be other measures taken to prevent incidents like this. But these aren't common.
Spending as well, whether it be on the police force or parts of its support system and indeed infrastructure.
You know, in the preliminary budget that the mayor released, you know, we saw the New York Police Department's budget remain, you know, relatively flat year over year. And, you know, it's the largest police department by far in America. And I guess what that means is that, you know, headcount is staying the same. And so it seems that at least from the public budget, that's not where the the technology will come from. But there are other places that police receive both technology and funds.
Fola, you've been all across the story for several days, emotional at the moment as well, I'm sure. Fola, going to be really great reporting in terms of the leadership of the city. Meanwhile, we want to take the justice perspective right now and, of course, what the accused perhaps now faces in the courts. Kenneth Gray, senior lecturer in the Criminal Justice Department at University of New Haven, I'm pleased to say, is with us. Ken, your perspective, what's been notable is the federal, of course, now prosecution that seems to be unfolding, and it's a terrorism-related charge.
So the reason for that, in my opinion, is the fact that there's a lot more exposure for Frank James here. That is, he's looking at this is Title 18 U.S.C. 1992, which is a terrorist act on a train or other modes of mass transportation. It carries with it a life sentence, up to a life sentence. That's far greater than he would get for this mass shooting that he did. So I think the decision to go federally on this is much more that of the exposure for the charge.
Ken, we are, of course, a global network, and sometimes federal versus local doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm the daughter of Crown Prosecution Service lawyers in the UK, where most of these sorts of prosecutions are done by the Crown, by the nation. What is the distinction between local law enforcement, local prosecution, federal prosecution, and how do you know which one's going to take charge?
So in this particular case, you saw at the event itself that there was a real enmeshment there between both state, local, and federal law enforcement. NYPD was identified as the lead agency on that case, but that there was input from the FBI, from the state police, from ATF, and so law enforcement was all working together. When it comes time to prosecute this case, the district attorney's office works with the U.S. attorney's office to decide which way the case is going to go. But I don't want you to get the impression that they were fighting among one another, but instead the decision was made to go federally because of the potential exposure here.
Of course, we are all innocent before being proven guilty. And it was interesting at the press conference, some labor was made of prior, criminal acts that occurred back in the 90s in the state of New York, but also the state of, you know, Philadelphia and New Jersey. What will that be made of in court?
So it shows a propensity to do violence, a propensity to do criminal acts. The person's criminal history is always brought into any case. So again, this is just routine that you would discuss for any suspect in a case. You would discuss their prior history, prior criminal history.
We are, of course, a technology show. And what's been interesting and what's been made of in the media and trying to understand who Frank James is and what his motives were is also questioning what his state of mind was, and people looking at YouTube evidence, people looking at his social media posts. How admissible is that in court?
Well, it's part of the public record. That is, he's posted on YouTube. There's no expectation of privacy there, so anything he put onto YouTube would be admissible. But I think this case shows very much that we live in a surveillance society, that there were cameras everywhere. The cameras on that platform failed. But the combination of a quick investigation was able to identify him. His picture was put out, and that was the thing that eventually either got him to call the Crime Stopper number himself, or some individual recognizing him contacted the police. It's not clear which way that actually happened at this moment.
Ken Gray, really great to have your expertise, of course. A lot of time spent interlinking the private sector with the criminal justice sector, and of course he is a senior lecturer of the Criminal Justice Department at the University of New Haven. We thank you. Let's just get to another Musk moment on Twitter Wednesday, because kind of fascinating really overall that we once again are seeing, well, just how you might expect, shares of lithium miner, that is Lithium Corporation, jumping 280% after a fake press release circulated on Twitter saying Tesla had acquired the Nevada company. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow spotted something was off, got to the bottom of it. He joins us again now. And Ed, talk to us about Tesla, about Musk, about what actually happened here.
You know, even by Musk and Tesla standards, this was odd, right? And I was sitting at my desk and I saw some tweets from some of the community that follow Elon Musk and Twitter, some of the Tesla owners and shareholders, and they were sharing screen grabs of a press release that said Tesla had acquired Lithium Corporation. You go on the Bloomberg terminal, look at the share chart, and just after 11:30 Eastern, the stocks jumped 280%. Hmm. But I looked at the image of the press release, and I thought, none of this adds up. 5W Public Relations, you may know them, Caroline, you know, well-known PR company, they don't represent Tesla, and they certainly don't represent Lithium Corporation. So we started hitting the phones, and of course it was a fake release, and there are still questions how it ended up on news wires. But what's astonishing is the release was published yesterday, on Tuesday, and the market's reacting. Look at that chart on Wednesday. It's been a wild day.
Official responses, actual technical official responses coming from the companies?
Yeah, so what happened was we got an email from the president of Lithium Corporation, Tom Lewis, who called this fake news. His words, fake news. There's no deal with Tesla. Of course, Tesla didn't respond. They don't have an active press or comms department. It was disbanded in 2020. And later, Lithium Corp actually issued a press release saying, you know, contrary to what had been reported, there was no discussion with Tesla. But here's the interesting part. Mm-hmm. They go on to say none of their employees left to go and join Tesla, but they'd be happy to chat with Elon Musk if he was so inclined. And we know this is an area Elon Musk is interested in, so maybe they're just shooting their shot, you know, taking their opportunity.
Talk to us about that area he's interested in, because he has talked about, on Twitter, funnily enough, lithium miners.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So, you know, lithium is a really core component that goes into the cell chemistry used in cells for EV batteries. And Elon Musk tweeted quite recently, just 5 days ago, that it's not that there isn't enough supply. There's abundant supply of lithium all over the world. You see it there in that tweet. It's the extraction that's the problem. And that, you know, domestic production of lithium here in the United States lags behind international markets. So there's been speculation this might happen. But on this occasion, I'm afraid, Caroline, this was fake news. There is no deal between Tesla and Lithium Corporation.
Ed Ludlow bringing us the real news. We thank you. Meanwhile, speaking of Musk using Twitter, let's talk about who used to lead Twitter, Jack Dorsey. And of course, ever since leaving that business and technically as CEO, has become more and more focused on next big vision, crypto, in particular Bitcoin.
If Bitcoin existed before Twitter started, I think we would see completely different business models. I think we'd see a lot less of the issues that advertising systems can bring up in terms of privacy and everything we're seeing around surveillance capitalism as well.
Jack Dorsey, Block CEO, of course, speaking in February at MicroStrategy's World Annual Conference. And now for more on this, I want to bring in Sarah Fryer for our Bloomberg Big Take, because it is a beautifully written story, a lot of obnoxiousness that goes in that makes you laugh. But talk to us first and foremost about Jack Dorsey and when his love for Bitcoin really first arose.
It really came to the forefront when Jack Dorsey went on a trip to Africa. This was, of course, the trip that activist investors later used against him, because when he went there, he saw how people were working with payments, how Bitcoin could be a really fundamental technology in a underbanked part of the world. And he was so inspired by that that he said he wanted to move there for 3 to 6 months sometime in the future. And the activist investors, of course, seized on that and said, well, you're not paying attention to the companies you run. Mm-hmm. Well, now he's not running Twitter anymore, but he's absolutely obsessed with Bitcoin. He's you know, as Kurt describes, the sort of spiritual leader of Bitcoin, and the idea that it has this sort of utopian, I should say, decentralized vision for how it can change the world.
Yeah, and it is a great headline, Bitcoin spiritual leader after Twitter. But of course, he's not just at Twitter. He is still, of course, CEO of Block, which is a fintech, which is a company that may well be used to embracing new forms of payment. And in that respect, what is his current role looking like at Block within the Bitcoin scheme?
Well, he's really trying to make Block a leader in the mass acceptance of Bitcoin, even going so far as to say Block will support people adding Bitcoin mining properties in their own homes. This is just where he thinks the future is headed. And one thing that Kurt Wagner points out in this great story, which we've seen through the last decade of Dorsey in tech, is when he sees where the future is headed, he tends to be right. He doesn't always execute on that vision perfectly, but he was one of the first investors in Instagram. He was the one who told Twitter to buy Vine, which, you know, died at Twitter, but was the format that later was popularized with TikTok. He over and over picks where the future is going to head. So what folks are saying is, if he's pointing towards Bitcoin as the future, we better pay attention to that.
Sarah Fryer, fascinating. We thank you so much. It's a great read, a great headline, great editing. And indeed, we thank you for bringing the Bloomberg Big Take.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde, in for Emily Chang. And in the pandemic, it brought about many young people, in particular, I think of the heady days of GameStop in 2021, it drew them to the stock market, an interesting place to be putting your money while you're sat at home. And interestingly, Atomic Invest is targeting these, maybe call them rookie investors, trying to allow normal people, you and me, to have access to the market's benefits. Joining us now, CEO David Dindy. Really interesting about the focus on financial inclusion at this moment. Now, there is this worry, perhaps, that with the euphoria that came with GameStop and everyone rushing into Robinhood, we then get back to our normal lives. We start wanting to get out, being sat in bars rather than trading online. But is there still that pent-up desire, and are we seeing wealth built by it?
I think that 2020 was a very interesting year. It got a lot of people to participate in the market out of speculation. But as you mentioned, as people are coming back to their normal days and their normal lives, there is that need for them to continue investing, but they don't have the time to think about their portfolio, to construct a diversified portfolio. And so part of what's very important right now is for them to have solutions that enable them to start building wealth, even if they don't have enough time to do the research necessary to start that journey themselves.
Okay, so how is Atomic Invest doing just that? How are you helping build out the infrastructure that allows us to have a diversified portfolio?
That's a good question. If you think about what it took Robinhood, Wealthfront, and Betterment and other digital investing platforms to create their infrastructure, it required about hundreds of millions of dollars, years for them to build and maintain that infrastructure. What Atomic is doing is enabling banks, fintechs, and credit unions to be able to very easily launch similar investing platforms in just a number of weeks without having to go through the burden of reinventing the wheel from scratch.
Uh-oh. So for the likes of Robinhood, which share price has been, shall we say, under pressure, competition, I assume. Everyone's going to be able to start offering a more accessible way to invest, right?
Yeah, in the next 3 to 5 years, we wouldn't be able to count the number of investing platforms in our hands. Investing will be ubiquitous. Banks, fintechs, credit unions, payment apps, anyone will have the opportunity to start their investing journey through these platforms.
Is the financial regulation there for it, though?
It is, in the sense that part of what we do at Atomic is we take over that regulatory burden for companies, for them to be able to offer investing without them having to build up the regulatory expertise to manage that solution, because we cover that for them.
David, I know that you're looking to move back to the U.S. I moved to the U.S. from Europe in 2018 and was dumbfounded by the lack of fintech. Seeming innovation. There seemed, and many felt that it was really being born in London, in Europe, because the regulation was there. Is that the case? Why do you think that there has been some stark successes, but perhaps fewer of them than we are used to over in Europe?
That's a great question. I think that by and large, financial services were concentrated among large institutions, large banks, large asset managers that provided a monolithic solution for everyone. I think what we've seen happen over the last couple of years is a lot of entrepreneurial activity around building platforms that are targeted at helping specific types of people. And we're seeing an explosion of this. Just in the last couple of months, we've been able to speak to over 400 fintech companies that are really focused on helping people build wealth, helping people have financial platforms that otherwise weren't available to them.
David, are you hopeful? Because, you know, you sit here with a fabulous education and with like a focus on what is deeply complex. I have the great fortune of talking about business day in, day out. But I know how, even for me, you know, intimidating, say, the world of crypto is because of the analogies that are suddenly used, because of the acronyms, because, and I feel that that's almost what Wall Street tried to build up back in the days of the heady days of 2008 with CLO this, CDO that. How intimidating is finance still for people who really are at the lower income space that we want to see included, that we want to see build wealth?
Very intimidating. We see that most people don't feel investing is for them because in the past, not as much effort has been taken to help them participate in investing. And so many people are still very risk averse. Many people require a significant amount of handholding. And I think this comes down to the fact that there is an educational gap when it comes to financial literacy and investing that has to be addressed in this country.
Yeah. How? Like, is that about education? Because at the moment, I see some really great content on things like TikTok and on Twitter, and I'd love to hope that like we and I can provide to that. But there's also a lot of rubbish on there too.
I think it's a three-pronged strategy. The first, let's say the ideal solution would be for investing education to be part of the high school curriculum so that people can learn what investing is and what investing isn't, so that people can learn the benefits of not putting all your eggs in one basket, but really about diversification. I think that would be, in the ideal world, what would be best.
What we're seeing happen today is actually quite interesting, where there are platforms that Atomic, for instance, is working with that are targeting people who have been disenfranchised in the past and allowing people essentially to be able to participate in investing and to educate those people in the context in which they are. I do think that work also has to be done through social media and through influencers because, as you mentioned, most of the content that's out there might be focused on what's buzzworthy. Mm-hmm. And if someone is receiving their investing tips from there, it's likely they'll end up with a basket of individual securities or asset classes that aren't diversified. And so I think a lot of work has to be done as well in not only having voices that are speaking about what's trendy, but also voices that are thinking or speaking about the benefits of planning for the future, diversification, asset allocation, and other principles of investing that are very important to adhere to.
Well said. Hopefully you can keep being that influence. Atomic Invest CEO, co-founder David Dindy there. We want to go back to another key story we've been tracking here at Bloomberg because New York City law enforcement officials have arrested Frank James, 62-year-old in Manhattan, in connection with Tuesday's shooting at a Brooklyn subway station. He will face federal terrorism charges. We're joined now by Bloomberg's Skylar Woodhouse, who's been tracking this from an infrastructure sort of perspective. We are a technology show here, of course, and what's been really demonstrative is perhaps the worry about lack of investment in our transit. And indeed, you know, it was largely blamed on the MTA that the cameras at that subway station weren't working, malfunctioning, for example. Tell us a little bit about the state of the MTA right now.
Yeah, so the MTA for years has been trying to catch up and basically become this, you know, modern transportation agency. They're trying to keep up with Tokyo and London and Paris and what's happening abroad. And, you know, so this incident is not really helping in terms of looking at the actual infrastructure of the MTA. The cameras weren't working when the shooting happened. So, you know, there's a lot that the MTA has to reconsider and now take a step back and look at so that way they can continue to basically, you know, make this system as modern as possible, especially with technology advancing so rapidly. You know, they have to keep up with the pace of the demand of technology.
And to be fair to the MTA, perhaps there is camera footage taken at different subway stations when we know that the accused did ride later on in the day and we're able to piece that together and eventually apprehend him in East Village a little bit earlier. I'm interested in now, you know, for people who are based around the world right now, what is it like? How comfortable are we getting on a transit system, a mass transit system at this moment where we didn't want to get on it anyway because of COVID?
You know, I think now that now that Frank James has been caught, I think there's a little bit of relief to riders, but there still is this lingering thought in the back of people's minds where it's like, what's going to happen next? Do we know when, you know, something else could happen? Who knows? It might not be a shooting. It could be a train colliding with another train. You know, there's so many different safety components to riding the subways, and, you know, I think a lot of people have that in the back of their mind right now. Given the pandemic and so much happening in the world, like a lot of people are they're on edge a little bit, and, you know, they're worried, you know, because no one knows what will happen and when it will happen, and they don't want to be that person.
Of course, much pressure currently being placed on the administration, a new, relatively new administration, to invest in public infrastructure. Of course, the infrastructure bill in and of itself from a federal level likely to help. Mm-hmm. But will it? Where do you think the duress is at the moment to put money to work in the MTA?
You know, I think the biggest issue right now for the MTA, or one of the issues, is just it's bringing riders back to, again, so that way it can bring in another source of revenue, yes, but also just to get service back to where it is pretty, you know, reliable for its customers. And I think once the service gets back to a steady pace and just a more routine, kind of going back to what it was pre-pandemic, then we might start to see progress get better, essentially. I mean, they're bringing in a new chief, a new subway president. So, you know, he's like, okay, we got to improve subway service, so therefore improve ridership, to therefore build on, you know, all of the layering issues facing the MTA.
Here's to a virtuous circle. We thank you, Skylar Woodhouse. Some great reporting there.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Time for our crypto report now, and we've learned that the much-anticipated Ethereum merge, well, it likely will be completed in, well, a few months after June, according to one of the leading Ethereum software developers. Let's bring in our crypto contributor, Shanali Basak, for more on this. The merge, of course, the much-anticipated way in which we go from proof of work to proof of stake, and talk to us a little bit about, you know, how this might be done in a few months' time.
Yeah, it's very interesting. This has been highly anticipated, as you have said, and now we have one of the leading software developers on Ethereum tweeting that this will likely be a few months after June. No firm date yet, but that we're in the final chapter likely of proof of work on Ethereum. Now, as you know, Bitcoin evangelists really have concerns about proof of stake over proof of work and debates around the energy consumption here, but this could really be a game changer for Ethereum that also has more than 100 billion worth of DeFi projects that are contingent on this merge.
Talk about some of the projects that spin off from this. Talk about other projects, protocols, other altcoins that actually we now sort of brace ourselves that could have it, their moment in the sun again.
Yeah, just a couple of days ago, we were talking about how altcoins were selling off more than Bitcoin. But now as you see Bitcoin emerge again and rise again, you are also seeing that on the other side. There are some altcoins like Avalanche that are rising at an even faster pace in the last 24 hours than Bitcoin. And if you track actually a group of 100 altcoins, you see that over the year, that group of 100 is actually also rising as a faster pace, and coin market cap really showing that Bitcoin is becoming a smaller percentage of the ecosystem at large as this altcoin universe expands. There's always that question, Caroline, what remains at the end of the day and what takes off? I mean, these layer one protocols also have gained a lot of excitement when it comes to not just Ethereum, but Bitcoin and that adoption of the Lightning Network really changing the way people use these networks.
Yeah, going on to Solana, Cardano, Avalanche, as you mentioned, plenty of exciting other areas that you can be investing in. And they're, of course, the ones in which perhaps aren't less tethered to a US dollar. But one area that we also wanted to discuss a little bit is stable coins and the use therein. We'll move on to our key story of crypto payments company Circle, also the issuer of the second largest stable coin, which is USD coin, just landing $400 million in funding from some of the biggest institutional players, BlackRock, Fidelity Investments. Very pleased to say that Jeremy Allaire is going to be joining Shanali and I, CEO of Circle. First and foremost, Jeremy, the $400 million, what is it going to be used for?
Well, thanks for having me on, Caroline. The $400 million has been part of our capital plan for continuing to scale, invest. We're growing internationally. We're building very significant investments in product development. We're investing in sales and marketing around, you know, getting more and more, you know, literally thousands of businesses to use USDC as an infrastructure to build on USDC as a core part of their applications, driving more use cases in payments, commerce, financial apps. So it's really investment capital and growth capital to continue to drive the incredible growth and adoption that we've seen over the past couple of years.
Incredible growth and adoption that is predicated on institutional players getting involved. Now, Fidelity, we know, had sort of pinned its horse to the race that is crypto and got got involved in this space earlier. But it was interesting that, well, BlackRock, to a large extent, we knew was helmed by Larry Fink and himself, a little bit of a cautious cynic, dare I say it, of the world of crypto, but had started to write about the infrastructure play, the payments, the way in which it could facilitate trades. Is that really what's going on here, the use of stable coins? Why would BlackRock get involved?
Well, look, we're very excited. This is a corporate strategic investment from BlackRock. It's not investing their clients' money, it's their own money. And alongside it, a strategic partnership has been formed between Circle and BlackRock, which is focused on, you know, the reserve management model for USDC. They are a primary manager of the reserves that back USDC, which is really important to get institutional acceptance for people to understand the safety, soundness, security of all this. But importantly, this is about how are we upgrading the fundamental financial market infrastructure of the way dollars work in capital markets? As we know today, the banking system doesn't move at the speed of the internet. There's counterparty risk, there's settlement risk, there's all kinds of challenges that are there. And I think BlackRock plays an incredibly large role in capital markets, managing $10 trillion of assets and dealing with that infrastructure. And so this is an opportunity to bring use cases for USDC. Certainly there are major use cases today in digital asset markets, DeFi, NFTs, cross-border payments. But in core capital markets, we see an enormous opportunity. I would say just the final comment on that is that, I think there's a belief in the opportunity in establishing dollar digital currency and private sector-led innovation in dollar digital currency. And I think BlackRock can be a huge partner for us as we try and establish that as a preeminent model that the U.S. can really get behind. Mm-hmm.
You know, Jeremy, there's this incredible convergence of TradeFi and DeFi here. And I'm wondering, you know, we've reported that you're closer to submitting an application to operate as a bank in the United States. A couple questions there. How soon can we see that kind of an application happen? And also, how much is that contingent on the regulatory environment that we're seeing right now?
Well, we're seeing tremendous progress in the regulatory environment. The policy discussion has shifted massively over the last year from one really focused on sort of the risks and challenges of stablecoins now to a world where, the head of the Federal Reserve, Secretary Yellen, the head of the OCC, the Undersecretary of Treasury, members of Congress on the left, on the right, Democrats, Republicans, this has become a nonpartisan issue, which is how do we ensure that dollar digital currencies become the currency of the internet, and policies moving towards that and making sure that large private sector actors are well regulated, that can have federal supervision. And so there's really been a move towards that. We're very excited about the progress that's being made in Washington, D.C., the engagement we're seeing from the OCC and others. And so we're very confident that this is going to become not only a federally supervised and regulated critical market infrastructure, but it's going to help the United States be competitive
in this digital currency arena. How important is this to you to get this done swiftly, perhaps even as early as this year in terms of becoming a bank?
Yeah. Look, I think our view is, I've sort of said this publicly multiple times. There's no OCC exam manual for a stablecoin issuer. This is a new arena. And so, we're dealing with multiple public blockchains. For example, USDC operates on 8 different public blockchains. What are the operational risk management procedures? What are the fundamental liquidity requirements? We're a full reserve, like a full reserve bank. We're applying to become a full reserve bank, not a fractional reserve bank. So there's a lot of novelty to stablecoin-based payment systems and banking. It's a new phenomenon. And so there's a lot of work to do to get that right. We're patient. We want to get that right. We're going to work collaboratively with regulators on that and ultimately get to a place where there's great supervision on critical market infrastructure that is going to be at the foundation of the economic system in the next 50 years.
What about collaboration with others in the space of stablecoins? I think of Tether, for example. I mean, is there a winner-takes-all? Do you think that you do need to collaborate together?
I mean, our view is, very specifically, we believe there needs to be, sound national policy and regulatory models around this, not just in the United States, but around the world. We're seeing really strong indications from the UK Treasury and UK government. We're seeing strong indications from other major financial market centers wanting to define the standards for this. So I think regulatory harmonization is really important, having those standards, but also technology standards. So, USDC itself was originally launched and is governed as a set of standards through the Center Consortium. We want to grow that and scale that and see more stablecoins and more currencies around the world that can follow these same set of standards. We think that kind of standards and interoperability as well as regulatory harmonization is what's going to really bring this to life.
You know, we're getting a question from a viewer, actually, Jeremy, and that's about USDT and Bitfinex. How would a potential fall of USDT mean for crypto?
I think that, we've seen incredible growth from things like USDC. We've seen incredible growth in this whole sector. I think major institutional players that are at the core of liquidity in these markets are very, very active in that. And so I think that the crypto economy is quite resilient and certainly would be resilient from an event like that.
We want to thank you so much for taking time, walking us through the funding, where it's going, the institutional adoption, a little bit about the competition as well. Jeremy Allaire, we thank you, Circle CEO.
Thank you.
And we thank Shanali Basak for the inside track on all things crypto. $925 million. That's how much some of the world's biggest companies are about to spend to buy offsets, carbon offsets, from startups that remove the CO2 from the air. Now, it's called the Frontier Fund. It's owned by Stripe, but it also got funding from the likes of Alphabet, Shopify, Meta. I want to get into all of this with Stripe's head of climate, Nan Ransohoff. And it's great to have some time with you, Nan. And talk to us, first and foremost, about the progress you made so far, how much you're really looking to be offsetting some of the impact that the businesses that you currently help the network and movement of funds contribute to climate change, perhaps withdraw some of that.
Right. So if we sort of start with the science, in order to hit global warming targets, we need to do two things. One, we need to stop emitting in the first place. And two, we need to remove carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere and ocean. We're going to need to do a huge amount of both, but we are particularly behind on the second, in part because we didn't really realize we were going to need to do as much carbon removal as we now know we do. And so our focus so far at Stripe has been with Stripe Climate. This started with a small corporate commitment. It's expanded to make it easy for many Stripe users to direct a fraction of their revenue to carbon removal, which we then pooled together and used it to buy even more carbon removal down the cost curve. But despite this current progress, we are still not at all on track to scale carbon removal to the required gigatons we need by 2050. And Frontier is really an attempt to get carbon removal on its best possible trajectory so that we have collectively the suite of solutions that we need to hit net zero in the coming decades.
Talk to us about how the fund came together.
It came together initially from, the genesis was really from internally the Stripe Climate team looking at the science and saying, while we have made a lot of progress, we have a long way to go. How do we really bend the curve up for carbon removal, knowing that we cannot do this just by ourselves? And so this really sort of formed the impetus of going out and starting to talk to a number of companies of, how do we send a really loud demand signal to the industry of carbon removal that there are going to be buyers for this technology, which really has been the missing link so far that has sort of paralyzed carbon removal in many ways.
Talk to us about the startups that are tackling just this. How do you analyze them? How do you evaluate the impact that they're going to have?
Yes. So we are starting to see a really diverse set of companies that are attempting carbon removal, and they're all over the map, right? So everything from traditional direct air capture, like Climeworks, which kind of looks like these giant fans pulling CO2 out of the air and injecting it underground into basalt rock where it mineralizes. We have Running Tide, which is doing kelp sinking, essentially growing these large columns of kelp biomass in the ocean and then sinking that to the bottom where it stays there forever. And then, Charm Industrial is another example. They're taking waste biomass, like corn stover, turning it into bio-oil and injecting it back underground. We're seeing a huge amount of diversity in the kinds of approaches to this, and that is exactly what we need. We need an order of magnitude more attempts here so that we have this portfolio that is going to collectively get to the 6 billion tons we need by 2050 every single year.
I hate to ask an awkward question, but it's one that at the moment perhaps some people see when they see Stripe and investing and the fact that perhaps the previous series and rounds that you invested in one company didn't go completely right. How do you ensure you got the right founder in place? How do you ensure that you got all the right sort of driving factors behind a business?
So I'll make one sort of important distinction, which is in the case of Frontier and in the case of Stripe Climate, we are buying carbon removal. So think of us like the customer. We're not taking an equity stake in these companies. And this is really stems from the fact that, you know, when with energy, for example, there is an end user of energy. We consume energy and humans derive value from that. With carbon removal, there's no intrinsic buyer because, you know, we're putting it under the ground and storing it there permanently. So nobody has historically wanted to buy carbon removal, especially when it's early and expensive. And, the you know, as a result, if you're a founder, why would you start a company if nobody is going to buy the thing that you're selling? If you're an investor, why would you invest in a company that doesn't have a revenue stream? So our theory of change here is if we are the customer, we can use that to pull project finance and we can use it to pull more founders into the space. So I'll just draw that distinction between these two companies. The other point I'll make is that, you know, this field is early and we should expect a number of these companies to not work. And that's okay. That is what an early ecosystem looks like. And I think we all need to collectively prepare for a lot of innovation. Some of these will work and some of these won't. But let's learn that now. Let's figure that out now so that by 2030, we feel more confident in the companies that we really want to double down on to scale up.
Well said, Nan. We want to thank you so much for talking us through really what the impact is and how you're going to be measuring your success. It's really fascinating. Nan Ransohoff, of course, Stripe head of climate, really thinking about carbon capture there and how to shift the dial. Now, of course, that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Don't forget to check out our new podcast. You can find it on the terminal as well as online on Apple, Spotify, iHeart. You don't want to miss it. Of course, plenty more coming up tomorrow as we dig into the world of technology and indeed the world of fintech too, with the helps of the focus on crypto. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.